coming down. In the middle of nowhere on a sickle moon night, we flew right past that scene. Turn to the flames that will hunt you in the sky. People stood and stared. We witnessed the owner, his head in his hands. We saw the moon wired to the sky. Just kept driving, God knows why. Standing by a light in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. I look right into his eyes, and it was just like looking into myself.
Today is March 12th, 2010. I'm Brad Pepink, and you're listening to News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a
Good evening, and thanks for joining us on this Friday evening. Today, we celebrate all that is international and in campus. And on campus, we bring you coverage of UBC's upcoming International Week. To Africa, we will be speaking with student organizers from the campus group STAND, formerly known as Students Taking Action Now, Darfur. We'll also be bringing you a roundup of international stories from our own News 101 reporter, Kieran Cuddy, and coverage of the investigation of the Lehman Brothers collapse, which found the corporation withholding key information. We'll have all this, plus your weekend weather forecast, the arts report, and headlines from Free Speech Radio News this hour right here on News 101. First up, I'm joined in studio with by CJ Kofed and Debbie Lin, who are here to discuss UBC's International Week, which begins this coming Monday, March 15th. Thank you for being with us in studio. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, happy
Thank
to
you.
Be
Pleasure
here.
Pleasure to be here.
First, maybe you could just, you know, fill me in. I'm an ignorant student. What is International Week?
International Week is a student-run, basically week-long event that highlights the international nature of UBC, the research here, and just the international nature of the student body. It's been going on for, last year was the 50th anniversary of iHouse itself, and then the 20th anniversary of iWeek, but don't quote me on that exact number. But this is just, it's just a great opportunity for students to kind of throw events about what they're passionate about and spread awareness about international issues.
Okay, so starting on Monday, is there a type of theme that's going to kind of glue everything together?
Our theme this year was breaking borders. We really wanted to not just break borders internationally, but really about breaking borders between faculties and different things like that on campus to really bring together students from SOTR, from science, from arts, from all the different faculties and things like that on campus to really make it more of a global UBC event rather than just involving international students.
So are you trying to say that there are international students in more than one faculty?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes, and this event is supposed to be a showcase for us to spotlight what
are all the international activities happening throughout the campus and in different faculties and units. So it's open to all students, not just international students, and open to faculty and staff as well.
So maybe you could give us kind of a highlight of some of the events that are going on. Are there speakers, workshops? I believe there's some rumors of beer.
Yeah, to address the rumor, yes, the rumor is true. There will be beer on Tuesday night from 5 to 7 at the Thea Corner, the Thea Lounge at the Corner House. We're having an international beer tasting night. So for $10, you can come on down and taste beer from around the world. It's great if you're kind of a novice about beer or you're a beer nerd. It's great for everybody like that. As far as what we're really excited about, this year, our keynote speaker is Paul Rusesabagina. For people that don't know, the movie Hotel Rwanda is based on Paul's actions in Rwanda, where he gave shelter and saved the lives of over 1,200 refugees. So he's speaking on Wednesday at the... Sorry, I've lost my train of thought here. He's speaking on Wednesday at the...
At the Chan Center?
Yeah, at the Chan Center. It's at noon, and the tickets are free, so we really encourage everybody who's interested to go to the Chan Center box office and get tickets, because it should be a really amazing talk. Also, if you don't know his story, if you don't know anything about that, Hotel Rwanda is playing for free at the Sub in the Norm Theater on Tuesday night at 7, too. Those are just a couple of things that we have going on. We also have International Food Fair on Monday night. That's at the Lada Center. iWeek is just chock full of events for people, whether you're interested in international food or international issues. There's kind of pretty much something for everybody, as cliched as that sounds.
Sorry, Debbie, were you going to?
Yes, I just wanted to add that the Chan Center box office is open from noon to 5 every day except Sunday. And to backtrack to the beer tasting night, it's a joint venture with UBC Wellness Center. And the Paul Rusesabagina talk is a collaboration with the Faculty of Arts International Student Relations Association, yep. The IRSA group.
Right. So Debbie, I was hoping maybe you could touch on, correct me if I'm wrong, you are an alumna of UBC.
Yes, that's right.
And so maybe you could tell us about the importance of UBC being an international institution. Is this something that kind of we can celebrate within Vancouver? You know, we just had the Olympics here. UBC Vancouver is obviously an international city. Does UBC live up to those international goals and kind of recognizing those students?
Yes, I think many universities across Canada and also across the world are also focusing on being an international-focused university. So UBC is not unique, but UBC does have a very healthy population of international students. And this vision of International Week is just to celebrate the international diversity on campus. And it's not just international students, domestic students, commuter students, students on campus. We also have a lot, large diversity of international population within the faculty members and the staff as well.
Right. Yeah. So maybe you guys could touch on some of the things that the International House is going to be doing in the future. Is this kind of the one big event that that happens to celebrate the international students on campus, or is there ongoing activities?
Yes, definitely. There are ongoing activities. We are launching also the Global Lounge, which the open house is going to be on Tuesday, next Tuesday.
And could you fill us in on the Global Lounge?
Sure. The Global Lounge is made possible by a donor, Dr. Simon K.Y. Lee from Hong Kong. And with that donation, the Global Lounge is possible, and this is the first year that it's been launched, and it's made up of about 20 founding member student groups on campus, and the vision is for the Global Lounge to facilitate international dialogue between student groups on campus.
And so, to my understanding, this is just an actual lounge in one of the residences on campus, and so the Marine Drive residence.
Yes, that's right. It's located in Building 1, in the Marine Drive residence.
Right, and so maybe you could just tell us about what it means for those students to have that type of space. You know, we all know how important it is to have your own space. We have the Student Union building, and faculties have their own buildings. And so why do we need to have an international house or a global lounge?
as a student who's been involved in international groups and things like that since I came to UBC, having a specific place where groups like URSA and where groups like STAN and all of these different groups with international goals and international motives at UBC can kind of come together and have kind of a cutting edge space to come together and collaborate, set new goals for the future, and just figure out kind of where we've been and where we can go as international students at UBC, whether it's graduates or undergraduates. Having a space like that is really, it's really been awesome. It's a beautiful building. People really need to go check it out.
Right. And can you, again, you know, you're saying that UBC is an international university as well as other universities. Is this Global Lounge unique to UBC? Is this something that we can kind of celebrate as Vancouverites, or is this, do we see this everywhere?
I believe the Global Lounge is unique. I believe the first one is in Hong Kong, and this is sort of modeled after that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for coming down. We really appreciate hearing what's going on with International Week, and we'll be sure to check out some of those events.
Cool.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to add that in the theme of breaking borders and introducing international students, for the first time we also have a Canada table at the cultural fair on Monday and Tuesday in the sub. And also for the grand performance, we also have a UBC staff who'll be performing with the other international students.
Great. Well, thanks again. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we have the members of the Student Initiatives, Students Taking Action Now Darfur, to speak about what they're doing on campus this week. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more, totally free, at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666, or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
UBC's International Week is March 15th to the 19th. Celebrate international perspectives and activities right on campus. You're promised to find something that will tickle your interest.
Attend a talk by renowned speaker Paul Rusesabagina. Fly by the cultural fair, have a bite at the food fair, or check out at the grand performance. Make iWeek a part of your week.
UBC's International Week, March 15th through the 19th. For more information, go to iweek.ubc.ca.
It was a beautiful day. I felt so...
When you experiment with cut-ups over a period of time, you find that some of the cut-ups seem to refer to future events. Well, we went on to exploit the potentials of the tape recorder.
Now, back to modern times.
Tape recorders.
Cut up, slow down, speed up, run backwards, inch the tape. That means work it back and forth across the tape head.
Hey, girls. Move a little closer.
Play several tracks at once. Cut back and forth between two recorders.
Copyright infringement. Piracy.
Oh, no, I pressed the wrong button again.
So cut-ups put you in touch with what you know and do not know that you know.
Exquisite Corpse, Thursday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. on the mighty CITR Radio 101.9, Vancouver.
This is not all rock and roll, dude.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard from the organizers of International Week. And to continue in our international theme, we now have some speakers who will be addressing what's happening in Africa. I have Nadine Qureshi and Gina Shenouda in studio with me, student members of the group STAND, formerly known as Students Taking Action Now Darfur. Nadine and Gina, thank you so much for joining me in studio.
Thank you, Brad.
Maybe you could just start us off by telling us what is STAND and where is Darfur?
All right. STAND UBC is a student-run organization that aims to promote awareness of ongoing genocides in order to mobilize individual and government action. We're actually part of a national organization that includes campus chapters across Canada. Darfur actually is a recent region in Sudan that's facing some serious conflict, especially in these past 4 years, as documented by the United Nations, but has been ongoing much longer than that.
So maybe you could tell us, what is genocide then? You know, we obviously use genocide for the Holocaust, and last week, or maybe it's this week, was Israel Apartheid Week, and so there's a lot of talk between Israel genocide, apartheid. What is genocide happening in Darfur? Could you clarify for that?
Well, they don't really like to refer to it as genocide, though the UN has. It's also known as ethnic cleansing. And basically what's going on down there is that you have the Arab militia group versus the Darfur tribal people. And there's a conflict going on between them, except one is fully equipped with weapons while the other one isn't. So basically they have the capabilities to cause violence while the other ones are pure victims of the situation. And the dilemma that's going on right now is that we believe that the government, well, not that we believe, we're pretty sure that the government is involved in the situation, and we want politicians to come up and step up and do something about it.
So maybe you could tell us about the movie that was actually shown on campus yesterday. The fine folks from the International Week were telling us about their keynote speaker for International Week, who is the real-life person that Don Cheadle portrayed in Hotel Rwanda. So what happened last night with a Darfur film screening?
It took place in actually the Norm Theater, and it was quite successful in turnout, and we were quite happy to see that much awareness was being promoted about this issue. The movie actually is a Hollywood-based film, so it was a documentary portrayal of the ongoing genocide in Sudan. It was quite graphic, but again, it was that shocking depiction of it really was, I think, necessary to really really depict really what's going on there.
So I think that raises a really interesting question, you know, the use of shocking imagery to kind of engage people. You mentioned that you're a student-run group and that you're trying to get politicians to kind of, you're trying to catalyze politicians, you're trying to get them to make action. How do you find the general knowledge is about Darfur, what's happening in Sudan? Is this, do you find a lot of what you have to do is just educate people, or can you kind of just help them kind of target their efforts?
Well, it's actually a really good question, because the thing is, when we tell people about STAND in just UBC, which is an institution filled with academians, a lot of people don't even know where that is. Like, it's not even recognized, or so it's like a matter of like going back to the basic, well, Sudan, it's like one of the largest African countries, and there's regions going on, and a lot of people are shocked, and that's why it's so important for us to do all these fundraising events, and like to show a movie like Darfur at the Norm Theater, because it's like, this is what's happening, and this is an area that, this isn't a movie, this is actually real life. This isn't, oh, because you know how we all said, like, with Hotel Rwanda, or, like, sorry, with the situation in Rwanda, that never again, right? But it is, it's happening right now in front of us, so it's a matter of telling people, because people who have the resources could possibly do something if they knew about it.
And in your opinions, what is Canada doing about Darfur? Is Canada ignorant as well, as a political entity?
I wouldn't say they're ignorant. I believe like there's lots of people doing something about it. I mean, it started off, I'm sure you've heard of Glenn Pearson, and if you haven't, he's an MP. Basically, he was a firefighter before, and he got interested in the issue, and now he's an MP representing it in Ottawa. So sure, it's like only one person out of 100, but like it's something to work with, and it's a matter of just telling people and raising that awareness again through our fundraising.
So maybe you could touch on when you do tell UBC students, is this something that they actually get involved with? You know, as students, we're constantly inundated, with the horrible things that are a reality in our lives, you know, the earthquakes in Haiti and Chile and all these tremendously awful things. Nadine, could you talk about what's happening, engaging with these students? You know, are you a large group and do you get a lot of support?
Right. Actually, we are quite a large group actually in UBC. A lot of our members just participate in our events and as well as promoting and fundraising for us. Primarily what we tell people to do when they haven't heard much about the issue is to read more about it, as well as come out to our events, as well as even call 1-800-GENOCIDE. And that's just a small action that you can take.
And what is 1-800-GENOCIDE?
It's a number that you can call and just to say that you support more political action towards genocide. Again, anti-genocide movements.
Right, and mm-hmm. to my understanding, it's a really cool initiative where it connects you with the voicemail box of the Prime Minister's office, mm-hmm. or is it the Foreign Affairs Minister?
I believe so, yeah.
The Foreign Minister.
Yeah. The Foreign Minister, and so you can kind of target your approach to lobby our government. Do you think that there's a lot more that individual Canadians can do, you know, apart from targeting our politicians and reading up about it? What can you do if, you know, this is something that really kind of gets the blood boiling?
Definitely involvement is key. As soon as you start taking action and get standing for your rights and human rights, more people know more about the issue, not just in Darfur, but about anti-genocide all over the world. And really the key is prevention in this case, too. How can we stop something like this from ever happening again?
Right. Can you maybe touch upon some of the other initiatives that STAND is engaging with right now?
So we have our upcoming panel discussion on Thursday, and we're inviting three keynote speakers right now for the discussion, including Senator Mobina Jaffer, who's our political perspective on the issue, as well as a student refugee from WUSC, and a professor at UBC, who's also giving his perspective on the human rights.
And so, Gina, could you touch upon this panel? What do you think it's, what are you hoping to accomplish with it?
Well, because they're from three different backgrounds, we're hoping to give you a broader sense, like, of what is going on, like, the different and the difficulties. Because the thing is, with genocide, it's not that solvable, because if it was, then it would be easily approached, correct? But it's not. So the reason is, like, you want to shed light on the complications and how difficult it is and what are the barriers. And so hopefully with this panel, we could see, like, it's maybe bring us closer to a solution, but at the same time, show how complicated it is. That's hopefully where we're going with this. And getting other people to get riled up and get the media more involved. I mean, at the end of the day, what people do is watch the media.
Right. Or listen.
Or listen to the media. Yeah, that's
right. So maybe you could, before we go, if students are really engaged with this idea, other than going to the panel, how else can they get involved?
Definitely check out our website. There's links to more information about what Darfur is, and as well as just come out, and you can also write a letter, actually. We have sample templates that you can actually write about, as well as become involved. We have weekly meetings every Friday, the Global Lounge from 3 to 4.
Yeah. So. And we have, like, now that it's the end of the year, where they're recruiting new members, so if you really want to get out there and you're really passionate, get yourself out there. Clean up that resume.
Actually, before we go, there's one last point that I want to bring up. Our last guest from the International Week, we're talking about the Global Lounge and how it acts as a space on campus for students to get involved. I was hoping maybe you could talk about the ways in which STAND functions as a group. You say, you know, you're looking for new members. I know that you each have a position within the STAND organizational structure. You have a president and that type of thing. Do you think that, in your opinions, as a student-run group, is having a Global Lounge like this, is this important to your operations?
Of course, it provides you with that open space where you can feel free to express your opinions, and like, it has no, I guess, academia background where you have to be smart about what you're saying or intimidation. It's just a free space for you to welcome for everybody, and it inspires actually international groups, if anything, to mm-hmm. continue doing whatever it is they need to do, because it's all about being aware and culturally aware also. That's how you become politically correct.
And maybe, Nadine, you could touch on, personally, as a student, do you find it hard to maintain this type of active commitment to a group? Is it hard to, you know, there's so much tragedy going on in Darfur. How do you keep yourself motivated to help out?
There's always different levels of involvement. So when it's really tough to be involved at certain times of the year, you definitely can take on a lower involvement role. But for sure, it's definitely the motivation itself, just about reading about the region and just about how much impact it's already had, is enough of a motivation just to keep up and be part of this.
Great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. Thanks for joining me in studio. We really do appreciate your efforts and for speaking with us.
Thank you. Great, thanks for having us.
No problem. We're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at some more international news from our own newsy Kieran Cuddy. That's right here on News 101 in Vancouver.
To the following 2009 CITR Fund Drive donors who donated during CITR News 101. Thank you, Dixie, Andrew, and Linda. Thank you to the following 2009 CITR Fund Drive donors. Thank you, Andrea, Shiraz, Sebastian, Shirley, Clarence, Julia, Patrick, Eldon, Mark, Adrian, Julie, Curtis, and Greg.
Ethical Bean Coffee is proud to be the Fair Trade Certified and Organic Coffee Supplier for UBC Food Service and Catering. Make your next cup with Vancouver's own Ethical Bean Coffee. Better taste, better value, better choice. Just better.
You didn't have to squeeze me like you did, but you did, but you did.
Thank you to the following 2009 CITR Fund Drive business donors. Thank you, Famous Foods, located at 1595 Kingsway. Fresh's Best Salsa at 2972 West Broadway. Havana Restaurant at 1212 Commercial Drive. Hell's Kitchen at 2041 West 4th Avenue. Our Community Bikes at 3283 Main Street. The Push Festival. Splits Grill at 4242 Main Street. 10,000 Villages at 2909 West Broadway. The Fall Tattooing at 644 Seymour Street. The Kiss Store at 2512 Watson Street. The NOM on 4th Avenue. The Templeton at 1087 Granville Street. Travel Cuts at UBC. True Value Vintage at 710 Robson Street. The Vancouver Playhouse and Vinyl Records at 319 West Hastings Street. Thank you to the following 2009 CITR Fund Drive business donors. Thank you, Banyan Books and Sound, located at 3008 West 4th Avenue. Bike Doctor at 137 West Broadway. Blim, 197 East 17th Avenue. Book Warehouse on 4th Avenue at 2025 West 4th. Cafe Etico at 2747 East Hastings Street. Costco in Richmond. The Dance Center at 677 Davie Street. Devil May Wear at 198 East 21st Avenue. Dizzy Cycles at 1856 West 4th Avenue. Dream Apparel at 311 West Cordova Street. Ethical Bean at 1315 Kootenay Street.
Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer counseling, accompaniments, information, and referrals. They also facilitate specialized workshops and training sessions, develop public education campaigns, and hold special events related to anti-violence work. All services are free and confidential. For more information on programs and services or on volunteer opportunities, visit their website, www.ams.ubc.ca/sasc.
Welcome back to News 101, streaming live online at CITR.ca and coming out of your speakers at 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Right now, we are joined in studio by our lovely weather person. We have Denise Diadic of the UBC Storm Club. And Denise, what can we expect for the weekend?
Well, we sure had pretty unpredictable weather changes this week due to different pressure systems from the coast that resulted in everything from snow and rain to sunshine. Tonight, a low pressure system from Washington will slide into southwestern BC, resulting in clouds and a few showers, low of 3 degrees. Saturday should be fairly mild due to a passing weak pressure system, high of 7 degrees, low of 3. Sunday will be cloudy with a chance of showers, high of 8 degrees and low of 4. And now it's time for some more weather trivia. Today's question is, what was the weight and size of the world's largest hailstone ever recorded, and where was it found? The answer will be revealed on next week's broadcast. That's your weekend weather forecast, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Currently, it's 6 degrees and clear at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diadic.
And Denise, before you go, is that a hailstorm in Canada or across the world?
Actually, it's across the world. Well, North America, to be specific.
North America. Interesting. Okay, thank you very much. And we look forward to hearing back on Friday what that's going to be.
Thank you.
Right now, we are lucky to have our arts coordinator at CITR in studio to present your weekend and your week in arts. For that, we turn to Tracy Fuller.
Thanks, Brad. Actually, it's not your weekend, but it is your Monday evening in arts, and it's good to be back in studio again after so long. As I'm sure many of you out there know, the Cultural Olympiad has been running full force since the beginning of January, and it shall go through to the end of March. And a bunch of international and Canadian acts have been brought into the city. We are lucky enough to have our very own National Arts Center Orchestra in town this weekend, and they will be performing at the Chan Center right here on UBC campus on Monday night. They're presenting a very special program entitled The National Arts Center's Made in Canada, and the concert features works and performances by artists from across the country, specially curated music that is supposed to represent the landscape of our country through music, through movement, and through a number of visual aids that they are using. It's a completely new program, ranging from everything from throat singing of the far north to an audio piece from the East Coast. And I was lucky enough to be able to speak with Christopher Deacon, the managing director of the National Arts Council Orchestra, earlier this afternoon. And here's a little bit of what he had to say about Monday night's performance.
For decades, people have been able to turn to great works of art like the Group of Seven and visual representations of what our country looks like. And now the National Arts Center Orchestra, along with many friends and artists from across the country, are trying to get a better sense of what the Canadian landscape sounds like. Can you talk a little bit about how this wide-ranging program came about?
Right. Well, it's a great question, and I think it captures exactly the spirit of the show. The spirit of the show is what we're trying to do is tell the story of Canada through the voices of its composers. And I think our view is that Canadians have become accustomed to hearing these stories through the voices of their novelists, their filmmakers and others, and so we really wanted to bring out the sort of to the forefront the way the Canadians composers see their country. And so putting the show together was actually a ball. There's a ton of great material to choose from, and we tried to pick pieces that were very evocative, because what we're looking for, not just sort of great pieces of abstract music, but great pieces of music that actually evoke the landscape, the people, what Canada's all about. So to give you a couple of examples, one of the pieces we're doing is called Elysium, and it's by a Newfoundland composer, a young woman called Katie Agoch. And that piece uses in it archival audio tapes of shipwreck survivors and witnesses, and the sounds of their voices are sort of woven into the music. But you really get a sense of place, that sense of the North Atlantic, the sort of storms around Newfoundland, And then there's a whole bunch of pieces like that throughout the concert, but that's one example. And there's a piece that's set in the far north, and it kind of creates postcards from Canada, and these sort of different images.
Well, I'm fascinated that about this piece specifically, Elysium, because when I think specifically of what does Canada sound like, when I ask myself that question, I think of Oscar Peterson and his Canadiana Suite, and I think of Glenn Gould and, of course, his Idea of North, and it sounds very much like perhaps these sounds, not just music, but sounds of voices, which vary across the country, are also being included in this performance.
Well, exactly, and in fact, I was just before this interview talking to Evie Mark, who's one of the Inuit throat singers who's performing Monday night, and she was describing to me the images of the North that are captured in the throat singing that they're doing, and the piece they're doing is called "Take the Dog Sled" by a composer who's a native of originally from Vancouver, Alexina Louie, but Alexina Louie incorporated into her music this traditional art form from the far north of the Inuit throat singing, and there's two or three different songs that the throat singers do as part of this larger piece, and one of them is called, is the words they're singing to each other is about the little puppy that was left behind, and they're actually creating the sounds of panting dogs as they're doing this throat singing. And so it's really very cool, and that work by Alexina is trying to actually, in the scraping of the bow across the double bass and these the various sound effects, capture the sound of the runners of the sled crunching through the snow, and so you really do get that idea of North in that piece. And so what was cool about not just picking these individual sort of postcards, but we wanted to weave it together to create a through composed arch. So you actually got a kind of story from beginning to end. And so we have used not just these six or seven pieces, but interstitials. We've created videos about the composers. We have we're using sort of visual imagery, spoken word. One of the pieces uses dance and lighting, so there is much more of a sense of a beginning right through an arch that takes you right through to the end of the evening, and that is one of the other things that's very cool about the show. Typically, when concert producers produce, especially in classical music concerts, you know, there's not maybe always a lot of thought about what happens in between pieces. Whereas if you go to a theatrical production, every moment of it is a kind of artistic expression. So we tried to, in a sense, move this show more towards that, so that the whole thing became a kind of a storybook about Canada.
A panorama from sea to sea to
sea.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that performance by the National Arts Center Orchestra, along with numerous well-known guest artists from around Canada, is on at the Chan Center this Monday night. That is March 15th at 8 p.m., and you'll be able to get tickets at the door. You can also visit the Cultural Olympiad site for tickets to that. But thanks again to Christopher Deacon, the Managing Director of the National Arts Council Orchestra, for taking the time earlier today to speak with me. And Brad, that's your arts for this weekend.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy. We really do appreciate having you on the show. It was quite a bit of fun. And for our listeners, I just want to say, Tracy, if people are interested, how could they get more from the arts?
Well, you can always get in touch with me by emailing the arts account. It's arts@citr.ca. And hopefully there'll be more stuff available online at our radio website, citr.ca, from the arts in the very near future.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it. And we're going to turn now to more international news. For that, we turn to one of our newsies, Kieran Cuddy, who's presented this roundup of international stories. Here's Kieran.
Hi, I'm Kieran Cuddy, and welcome to your international news roundup, where each week we try and bring you a range of stories linked by a common theme. Our attention this week is focused on Africa, and firstly, the northern Nigerian city of Jos. Before dawn last Sunday morning, groups of men armed with machetes were responsible for a spate of attacks across the city that left hundreds of people dead, mostly women, children, and elderly men. This massacre in a city that has been a traditional frontier between Nigeria's Christian South and Muslim North, is a third such clash between rival factions in the last decade. In September 2001, over 1,000 people were reported to have been killed in almost 2 weeks of sustained violence. Tensions between Christians and Muslims boiled over once again as recently as 2008, when over 350 were left dead in riots resulting from the outcome of a local election. While governments the world over have been quick to call for the arrest of those responsible, many aid organisations are concentrating their efforts on the humanitarian crisis brought about by the violence. Speaking to the BBC on Monday, Robin Waudo of the Red Cross in Nigeria had this to say.
At the Red Cross, we are more concerned with the humanitarian situation that comes out of this kind of violent clashes, because our main aim is to try and assist those who've been affected and to try and see how we can get them back to help those who've been wounded and those who've been separated, like the families that must have been separated yesterday, because we know that people have fled their homes. We have already got reports that about 600 people fled.
It is widely believed that the numbers of people fleeing the violence has since risen to the thousands and continues to climb. While the causes of the violence remain unresolved, more people feel forced to relocate, putting extra pressure on the aid agency's already overstretched budget. According to the UN, the numbers of internal refugees in Africa is already in the tens of millions, with vast amounts of these living in temporary villages that offer little in the way of sanitation or clean drinking water. In response to the violence and humanitarian crisis, elected officials from the region have called on the federal government to initiate an economic package specific to Jos in order to stimulate growth in the city and attract back many of the recently displaced. It is widely feared that unless this measure and others are not implemented speedily, Jos and its inhabitants are merely experiencing a stay of execution, and before long, violence will once again erupt on the streets. We now shift our attention further east, after fresh reports surfaced this week regarding the destination of monies donated to charities and aid organisations operating in the region. This story first came to prominence earlier in the month, when the BBC World Service reported that millions of dollars in aid for victims of the mid-80s Ethiopian famine were siphoned off by rebels in order to buy weapons. The fallout from that report included an assertion by Band Aid organiser Bob Geldof that all of the money raised by the series of concerts went exactly where intended. It has now emerged that in neighbouring Somalia, up to half of food aid currently donated to the country is diverted for nefarious purposes. This all according to a leaked UN report. The report details that the beneficiaries of food aid include corrupt contractors, local UN workers, and Islamist militants. Jeffrey Gettleman of the New York Times first broke the story. When the officially recognised government holds little influence, attacks by pirates have become rife, and law and order has effectively broken down, these latest reports would provide extra ammunition for those who assert that Somalia is an all but failed state, and that renewed efforts are required by the UN, Western governments and NGOs to tackle the nation's problems and help ensure that the basic principles of human rights are allowed to flourish. Finally this week, we bring you some good news from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Ahmed Mustafa, a well-known local blogger, was released from custody earlier in the week before his second court hearing relating to charges of publishing false news about the armed forces. Mr. Mustafa had posted an entry on his blog alleging favouritism in the military academy. The Egyptian armed services are notoriously sensitive of any criticism, and Mr. Mustafa was being held under an emergency law that allows civilians to be tried in military courts in certain circumstances. Rights groups have welcomed the news, with the Arabic Network for Human Rights saying that the issue should never have been referred to a court in the first place. Amnesty International, however, did voice some concern that the release of Ahmed Mustafa was conditional on his agreeing to apologise and removing the controversial entry from his blog. Well, that's it for this week. I hope you'll join us again next Friday on CITR 101.9 FM for another look at some of the important stories affecting our world today. I'm Kieran Cuddihy. Thanks for listening.
And we thank Kieran Cuddy for that coverage. That was a good roundup of the international stories that have been happening this week. We're going to take another quick break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking into the collapse of the Lehman Brothers Bank, as well as some headlines from the Free Speech Radio Network. That's all coming up on News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the Student Union Building in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The 10th Anniversary Vancouver International Dance Festival is taking place March 12th to March 21st at the Vancouver Playhouse and Roundhouse venues. The 2010 lineup includes Vancouver companies Mascal Dance, Kokoro Dance, Lumenco Rosario, and Out Inner Space. Ontario's Toronto Dance Theatre, Taiwan's Lafa and Artists, Denmark's Kit Johnson, New Zealand's Black Grace and Bill Crutchmaster Shannon, Michael Sakamoto, and Evidence from the United States. The 10th Anniversary Vancouver International Dance Festival. March 12th to March 21st at the Vancouver Playhouse and Roundhouse venues. Tickets are available at 604-662-4966 or online at vidf.ca.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh in the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're happy to turn now to our friends at the Free Speech Radio News, who have presented this piece about the collapse of the Lehman Brothers Bank and what's happening with the ongoing investigation into what happened.
An independent report on the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which is the largest bankruptcy ever filed, spreads blame throughout the financial system. The 2,000-page report was written by Anton Valukas of the law firm Jenner & Block and was released by the bankruptcy court in New York. Joining us to talk about the report is FSRN's Leanne Caldwell. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Dorian.
Leanne, remind us of Lehman's role in the financial industry.
Sure. Lehman Brothers was on top of its game in the mid-2000s. In 2006, the management actively decided to be more aggressive and take more risky transactions. Then a year later, the subprime crisis became apparent and Lehman failed to act. Finally, in January of 2008, they saw record profits, only to see those profits slip away and their stock plummet 95% in just 8 months. The government failed to intervene, and Lehman filed for bankruptcy, the biggest ever, on September 15th of 2008.
Now, does this report talk about why Lehman Brothers failed?
This report talks about a lot. The table of contents alone is just 38 pages. This is a 2,000-page report. But it does say that Lehman failed to act when they saw trouble. Instead, the company decided to get more aggressive in its transactions. The investigation places a lot of emphasis on what Lehman actually called themselves, quote, an accounting gimmick. It's called Repo 105. These are transactions where they manipulate their bank balance sheets drastically. Through this Repo 105, what Lehman did is they took $50 billion off their balance sheets each quarter. to falsely invoke confidence in the institution as it was really starting to drown. So it was all about math and psychology, what they did. In school, they would have failed math because they were using tricky and inaccurate numbers, but they would have excelled in psychological manipulation because they were just trying to convince people that everything was okay.
So no information that shed some light on the lead up to, as you say, the largest bankruptcy in history. Now, who is responsible for the collapse?
The report spreads the blame around. It blames the head of Lehman Brothers for using what they call, quote, poor judgment, and that they could have done more, and that the management exacerbated the situation by not having a backup plan or a fail-safe plan, but by continuing to take risky and riskier transactions, and especially implementing this repo 105, these accounting manipulation transactions. They also blame the accounting firm Ernst & Young. That was Lehman Brothers' accountant. Ernst & Young knew that Lehman left off $50 billion off their balance sheets through this repo 105 transactions, but they failed to tell the audit board and they failed to investigate it. Instead, they completely ignored it. And this has led to, major troubles for Lehman. But they also find fault with J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank. They say that this investigation finds that Lehman's failures because they did not have enough liquid assets. They did not have enough cash on hand. In the final days, when people knew that Lehman was going under, J.P. Morgan and Citigroup asked for their money. They demanded their money that was owed to them. And they said that that was a direct reason for Lehman going under. Handing over that cash means that they were no longer able to survive.
So you mentioned the roles of other institutions like J.P. Morgan or Citibank. Is the failure of Lehman the reason for this financial crisis?
The report doesn't point out specifically that Lehman is the cause. Instead, they say that it is a result, that what happened to Lehman is because of the financial crisis. So they don't blame Lehman. They blame the entire banking system.
And what will happen next with this report?
Very likely many litigation firms out there who represent plaintiffs who are out there scouring this report and possibly trying to see if they can bring charges against people who are cited in this report or for Lehman's actions. So it's still wait to be known, but we do know that this report did shed a lot more light on what happened in the collapse of Lehman.
That's FSRN's Leanne Caldwell joining us to talk about a new report detailing what happened with Lehman Brothers leading up to the bankruptcy. Thanks so much, Leanne.
Thank you, Dorian.
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for allowing us to air that on our show. We're going to turn now to another quick break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the headlines from the last week from the Free Speech Radio News. This is Brad Pepping, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right up. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
The UBC Learning Exchange Trek program wants you to get involved in your community.
Learn about important social issues while volunteering at inner-city schools or nonprofit organizations. You'll also get to meet other UBC students in a fun and supportive environment. See how your talent and skills can make a difference in your community. Participate throughout the term or during Reading Week. Check out www.learningexchange.ubc.ca/CITR to find out more.
Industrial, noise, and goth. Tune in to the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights right here at 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver, www.citr.ca.
I can listen to them and go, this is really cool stuff. And people don't make music like this. They never have, and they never will. This is really cool stuff, and people don't make music like this, and they never have, and they never will.
Probably the closest to my heart.
Welcome back to News 101. We're almost ready to let you get on with your Friday evening, but before we do that, we have a roundup of what's happening in the world with headlines from Free Speech Radio, Radio News. For that, we turn to them.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After a delay of nearly 8 years, thousands of rescue workers and responders to the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York City will be compensated for the toxic exposure they faced at Ground Zero. FSRN's Salim Rizvi reports from New York.
It's being called a momentous settlement, awarding $657 million to some 10,000 responders to the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks. The workers were exposed to various harmful substances and chemicals at the site, which caused injuries and the development of serious diseases. Mark Byrne is the attorney for the firemen, police officers, and other rescue workers hurt in the cleanup.
We believe that the compensation to each of the clients will be fair and just for the men and women who perform their duties at Ground Zero, heroically and without any thought when they went down there of any compensation.
A major legal issue in the case has been whether the injuries were actually caused by exposure at Ground Zero. The settlement will be paid by the federally funded World Trade Center Captive Insurance Company. The company was created to deflect liability from the city and other private companies employed to clean up the site. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has passed a bill aimed at reducing the federal sentencing disparity between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine offenses. Since the 1980s, crack cocaine offenses have been punished at a much higher level, a difference many activists call systemic racism, because crack offenses are more common among minority populations. Senator Dick Durbin.
What is my position? My position is for one-to-one equity and equality in sentencing. But in order to get things done, you have to be prepared to make mutual concessions, and that's what we have done. It sets the threshold for a five-year mandatory minimum at 28 grams, which is roughly the equivalent of 1 ounce. This would establish a crack powder ratio, not 100 to 1 as in current law, but 20 to 1.
Prison reform groups have applauded yesterday's move, but are still concerned it doesn't go far enough to ease the disparity. The bill would not change the sentencing for those already convicted on crack offenses. The House Judiciary passed its own version of the bill, making sentencing guidelines for powder and crack cocaine equal. A 48-hour border closure of the West Bank began last night. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak issued the order to prevent clashes between Palestinians and Israeli police, but to no avail. Palestinian anger is high after the Israeli prime minister announced the approval of 1,600 new Jewish settlements in the West Bank. FSRN's Ghassan Benor reports.
Israel deployed police in the old city of Jerusalem and around all Palestinian neighborhoods. Despite their heavy presence, clashes started around midday when Israeli soldiers did not allow men under the age of 50 to enter and pray inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the old city. Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest site for Muslims. The site is also significant in Judaism. A number of local youth were injured by police fire. In East Jerusalem, Israel arrested 11 at an organized protest in the Palestinian neighborhood Sheikh Jarrah. The residents, along with Israeli and international supporters, marched to protest home demolition and evictions of local families. Israel wants to evict Sheikh Jarrah and replace it with an Israeli settlement. Ghassan Barnoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Up to 300,000 stateless refugees are languishing in dire conditions along the Bangladesh-Myanmar border. Ethnic Rohingya, fleeing persecution from the country, also known as Burma, are now the target of a crackdown by the Bangladesh government. From Dhaka, FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
Human rights groups accuse authorities here of waging a war of intimidation against hundreds of thousands of refugees in an attempt to dissuade more ethnic Rohingyas from crossing the border. Rohingyas are Muslims descended from 7th century traders. Since the 1970s, hundreds of thousands have fled persecution from Myanmar's ruling military junta and are living in refugee camps across the border in Bangladesh and Thailand. The Bangladesh government has refused to grant Rohingya migrants refugee status, denying them UN legal rights. Now doctors groups say security forces and police are rounding up migrants and pushing them back across the border. Inside the largest camps, investigators from Physicians for Human Rights reported this week that nearly a fifth of children were suffering from acute malnutrition and described the overall situation as a humanitarian crisis. Doctors Without Borders has made similar findings and say rape and beatings are common for camp dwellers who have no protection under the law. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Dhaka.
Today, European countries shifted their strategy for addressing environmental health risks. The new plan ties efforts to improve health with those aimed at reducing social inequality. The World Health Organization says the groundbreaking integration of the overlapping issues will help push action higher up the political agenda. For FSRN, Jenny Johnson reports from Russia.
For the first time, the new targets explicitly acknowledge that environmental risk is tied to economic status, gender, age, and ethnicity. A report released at the World Health Organization meeting in Italy found significant social inequalities in exposure to poor water quality, toxic air pollution, and other stressors. In addition, women are more exposed than men to such negative conditions, while children and the elderly are more vulnerable to environmental health risks. Western, Central, and Eastern European countries, including Russia, joined the agreement. The new criteria means programs to improve health will now be those that target social inequality. Jenny Johnson, FSRN.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Again, we thank the Free Speech Radio News for allowing us to air those headlines on our show. Just to let you know, that is a regular feature that we hope to be introducing into News 101. So catch us on Monday for more of those headlines from Free Speech Radio News. And ladies and gentlemen, that's our program for March 12th, 2010. We are proud that today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments or give us a hot news tip, you can contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. If you want to get involved in the show or show us your support, you can friend us on Facebook with username CITR News, or you can start following us on Twitter, again with username CITR News. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program, and for more news, please join us on Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink, and for the entire news team at CITR, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for A Hot Mess right here on 101.9 FM CITR.
Here you are, take it slow.